From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, we'll get an update on where things stand with the rules affecting Michigan's marijuana industry.
We believe that most of the people that are currently existing in the system, in the business program, will not be eligible for participation in the new business climate that's being created by the legislature.
The pros and cons of storing nuclear waste near the Great Lakes.
Low-level waste is obviously transported to these sites every single year in the droves and has never caused a radiation release to the local communities around them.
Plus, we'll hear about some of Michigan's prison history.
You had the cheap labor of prisoners, and your town was guaranteed to become a thriving industrial town.
And we'll meet the owners of the North Manitou Shoal Lighthouse.
The safety, the weather, the water, there are a lot of variables.
But first, here's the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Medical marijuana has been legal in Michigan since 2008. In a few cities, such as Ann Arbor and Grand Rapids, recreational use and possession has been decriminalized, although you can still get a civil infraction, a fine. Medical marijuana dispensaries have popped up across much of the state. Local ordinances determine how many, where they can locate, and even the hours of operation in some cases. To get a Michigan pot update, we're joined by Rick Thompson. He serves on the boards for Michigan Legalize and Michigan Normal. That's the state chapter of the National Organization of the Reform of Marijuana Laws. So tell us, what's the latest on medical marijuana facilities licensing in law?
Well, the latest is the rollout of the Medical Marijuana Facilities Licensing Act, which was passed in 2016 by the legislature and signed by the governor. December of this year, they'll begin issuing applications for new distribution centers, testing centers, transporters, cultivators, and processors in the state.
So basically, we're setting up the whole distribution and network system from seed to use, right?
Well, what we're doing is reinventing the entire thing because it already exists.
Right.
Yes, and of course, we can call it a gray market if you wish, but there's been a robust industry already existing in the state since 2009 when the first program rolled out.
Now, there's a 3% tax now, too, right? Is that correct?
There is a tax on the new medical sales that'll be gone through the regular medical shops that they roll out in 2018.
So are the dispensaries angry about that or welcome it? Or, I mean, does this legitimize them? What do they think of the 3% tax?
Well, the 3% tax itself, I think everyone wants to contribute to the state itself in one way or another. We all want to see better roads. We want to see better schools. We want to see cleaner streets. But the concern is that the existing business community is going to be left out or completely eliminated from this brand new business program. And that seems very unfair to people that have spent the last 7 years building up an industry and creating the success base upon which this new set of businesses will be born on.
Explain that.
Since 2009, industry has sprung up on its own. We understand that there's a need for distribution, there's a need for testing, there's a need for cultivation inherent within the medical marijuana program. So although it existed without state sanction, it certainly did exist and employs thousands of people across the state to this day. The new Medical Marijuana Facilities Licensing Act will only allow people who are state certified and state sanctioned to participate. And we believe that most of the people that are currently existing in the system, in the business program, will not be eligible for participation in the new business climate that's being created by the legislature.
Is that because they have a criminal record or what is it?
No. In fact, most of the people that are patients or caregivers don't have criminal records. In fact, there are some background checks that you must go through in order to be qualified as a caregiver.
So why would they be restricted or prohibited from becoming licensed under the state now?
Well, we would like to know the same thing too. We're really concerned by the Licensing Control Board. It's a 5-member board that's going to approve all of the participants in the new Medical Marijuana Facilities Licensing Act. One of the 5 members is a former Michigan State Police sergeant, Sergeant Bailey. Sergeant Bailey said that if we didn't trust you to follow the rules under the old program, why would we trust you to follow the rules under the new program? The problem is the people that are currently within the business community that have built for 7 years believe that they are following the rules. And as evidence, we point to the fact that they've existed for 7 years without being raided or without being destroyed or without being taken over by police. Is that not a sanction in some way for the behavior that you're doing?
Let's talk about Detroit for a second. The city shut down a lot of dispensaries, although it appears a lot of them are still operating illegally or unlawfully. What's happening there?
Well, that's a question. Are they operating illegally or unlawfully? The city of Detroit says 75 centers can continue to remain open and do the same business as they did, the same type of style of business they did, while they're in the approval process.
That's just a fraction of the number of dispensaries.
Well, there was at one point between 250 and 300, according to popular surveys. 75 at this point, so being in the application process, and only five of them having actually been approved for licenses by the city. That says that the city of Detroit believes 75 of those are not harming the community and they're going to allow them to exist. That would stand in contradiction to the Michigan State Police's position that all of these centers are harmful to the communities and must all be destroyed.
Are there any other cities shutting down dispensaries, or have they gone through these start and stop situations? I recall Ann Arbor shut down some dispensaries at one point.
What we've seen from cities is that most of them are taking a hands-off approach to the distribution centers unless a problem is created. We've seen law enforcement agents go in and address a situation at one single facility while they drive past several others to get there. And the reason is those other several are doing things properly, and one of them perhaps is not. So that's the type of sanction that we're looking at here from our local communities and from our leaders.
Let's talk about recreational use for a second. It's, as I mentioned, Grand Rapids, Ann Arbor. I'm sure there are other cities in the state that allow it. There's also a proposal to legalize recreational marijuana. How's that effort going?
Very well, actually. The signature drive for the Committee to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol in conjunction with the MI Legalize organization has hit all of our targets for signature collecting to this point. We are where we need to be in order to file properly, make sure that we have all of our signatures collected within that 180-day window.
I also understand that you've been getting political donations that will help, if this gets on the ballot, to help advertise with it. Is that correct?
All of the donations being received by the CRMLA right now are dedicated to the petition drive itself, to pay the paid petitioners and also the staff that's necessary to run that operation in the state of Michigan.
Now, this effort to legalize marijuana is not without its critics. We're seeing a lot of them. How likely is it that the effort can be derailed by this opposition?
Not very likely. Once we're on the ballot, once we're approved for the ballot, we believe that the public sentiment is in our favor. All the polling data indicates that the citizenry of Michigan is ready for legalized marijuana. They're ready for the revenue stream. They're ready to redirect their police forces towards more violent crime and towards more appropriate places.
So we've been talking about what's going on in the state, but the U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions wants to get rid of the federal protections that were approved for states where medical marijuana has been approved. Sessions says since we've got a historic drug epidemic, meaning the opioid crisis, then a crackdown on marijuana, which he considers a gateway drug, is warranted. What's your take on the U.S. Attorney General's plan for a crackdown?
Jeff Sessions has been stymied two separate times in his effort to crack down on recreational and on medical marijuana use across the United States. In one, the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment was reinserted back into the budget, which is an amendment.
Yeah, tell us about that amendment. Yeah,
that amendment prohibits federal agents from using federal funds to prosecute state legal marijuana activity, whether that is state legal medical marijuana activity or state legal recreational activity. That's been in the budget for several years. It's odd that it's put in as a budget amendment, but that's the way they do it. Attorney General Sessions tried to have that struck from the budget, and he was unsuccessful. He also sent a letter to states asking them to individually take action against medical marijuana. Governors of the states have rejected that also. Sessions has not been successful in his jihad against the marijuana community.
Well, new budget's coming up. I mean, we just basically passed a stopgap budget, the end of the fiscal year is in the fall. Are we going to go through this again?
I think every year they go through some kind of a stopgap. The budget itself is so large and massive, it's impossible to assign any kind of budgetary difficulties just to the one marijuana issue. The Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment is just a tiny thing in the giant pool of problems they have in Washington.
I guess that's not my point. My point was Sessions is going to have another chance to convince members of Congress to get rid of the amendment. And I'm wondering if you expect him to continue to do that and if you think he'll have any better luck in the coming budget talks.
I believe Jeff Sessions is going to continue to follow his instinct, which is that marijuana is a negative factor on the society. So regardless of popular opinion, regardless of congressional action or direction from the president, I think Jeff Sessions will continue to work against marijuana interests during his entire tenure.
Rick Thompson is with Michigan Legalize and Michigan Normal. Thanks for the update.
Thank you very much.
The federal government has been auctioning off Great Lakes lighthouses. A recent group around Michigan were all offshore lighthouses, including the North Manitou Shoal Light, which is just south of North Manitou Island. That's in Lake Michigan, just off the Leelanau Peninsula. Basically, it's a 15-minute ferry ride from Leland. The nonprofit North Manitou Light Keepers bought the lighthouse, which is known locally as The Crib. Anna Oginski is with North Manitou Light Keepers. Now that you've acquired the lighthouse, what are the long-term plans for it?
Well, we are getting to work this summer to start renovating it. Our goal is to have it complete by July 2021 so that we can open it to the public for tours and eventually, hopefully, make it so that people can come for overnight experiences as volunteer lightkeepers like they do at other lighthouses around the country.
So can you describe the lighthouse for us?
Sure. It's offshore. It's built on a structure that's called the Crib. That's where it gets its name. And that's made of wood and concrete. And then it has three stories and then the actual light structure on the very top. And it includes living quarters and other space to work from within the lighthouse.
So what kind of money is it going to take to restore this? It sounds like it's going to take quite a bit of time.
Right now, our estimate is about $1.2 million.
That makes the few thousand dollars that you paid for it sound like maybe that's just the very beginning of the investment.
Exactly.
So as we described, this light is basically on a large concrete block offshore. What kind of obstacles do you face in restoring a light like that? Because you can't drive up, you can't have lumber delivered to you or anything like that. It's all got to be by boat.
Right, by boat, and also the weather. We've already had a couple experiences where we had planned to go out there, and we couldn't because of the wind. Right now, there isn't a way to secure a boat to the Crib safely, so we have to think about that, too. The safety, the weather, the water, there are a lot of variables.
The Northern Manitou Shoal Light was built in 1935, which is fairly recent for a lighthouse. How long was it in operation?
The crew stopped living there around 1980, and then the equipment became automated.
Oh, so the Coast Guard's still using it?
Yes, that's part of the deal. The Coast Guard will continue to use it.
Okay, so they just got an automated signal or an automated light? What do they have there?
The equipment is automated. To be honest, I don't understand the exact details.
So what was it about this particular lighthouse that attracted your group to it?
I think it was the location, that area, the Sleeping Bear Sand Dunes, Lake Michigan. It's a special place to all of us from when we were kids growing up in Michigan.
That is Anna Oginski with the nonprofit group North Manitou Light Keepers. They have just purchased the North Manitou Shoal Light, which is just south of North Manitou Island. Thanks very much for talking with us about this.
Thank you, Lester. We appreciate it.
Coming up, we'll take a tour of Michigan's oldest prison with a historian who lives there.
My feeling is this history is utterly fascinating. It's such a part of Jackson, of Michigan, and of humanity.
That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Let's get out of the studio and go get locked up.
What are we going to do?
Road trip.
We are in Jackson right now, and we're at Michigan's very first penitentiary. We're talking with the author of the book, Jacktown, History and Hard Times of Michigan's First State Prison by Judy Gale Krasno. Tell me about the beginnings of this prison, because it was the first and probably not the massive stone walls that we see now.
The first prison, after Jackson won the battle to have Michigan's first state prison, was a wooden fort. It was the Wild West. And they thought, well, forts protect people, so we'll build a fort. Unfortunately, they found out the hard way that that wasn't the case with prison, because in 1840, 10 very vicious inmates escaped to become the Jackson Robber Gang, and they had no competition, so they ruled the roost. They robbed coaches, they robbed cattle, they robbed horses, they robbed people, they killed, you name it, they did it. So Jackson and the state decided we had better build a brick and stone and mortar and iron prison, and they did.
So let's talk about Jackson and how hard it fought to get a prison because of a commodity.
Yes, the commodity was the cheap labor in the Industrial Revolution. If you had a penitentiary and you had factories, you had the cheap labor of prisoners, and your town was guaranteed to become a thriving industrial town.
Now, the prisoners were paid 33.5 cents per day, but where did most of that money go?
Most of the money went to the state. 28 cents of it, as a matter of fact, 5.5 cents went to the poor prisoner and 28 to the state. So it was a win-win situation.
And at the time, wages were about $1.50 a day. They were actually earning 5.5 cents a day.
That's right. I mean, if you were a non-convict factory worker, depending on your skills, it was $1.50 to even $2.50 a day. But compare that to 5.5 cents. So part of the punishment, so they called it, and part of it was rehabilitation. They would come out with skills. But as my book states later on, those skills, because of the 1909 law saying you couldn't have a factory on the prison that was also in the town. In other words, prison couldn't compete with private. So they would gain skills and get out and not have the skills needed for the factories outside.
The prison cells were tiny. If you can imagine spending much of your day in a 5.5 by 4.5 foot space. People were not as tall then, but some of them were. Imagine not being able to fully stretch out as you slept. And the idea of pacing in your cell, ludicrous.
I mean, this was totally claustrophobic. There was no ventilation in this room, which was the original stone brick and mortar west wing. And that's what they had to spend their time in.
The stench of the place was unimaginable. There were no toilets. Prisoners used a chamber pot, a bucket. They called them honey buckets. They were dumped once a day. As we toured the prison, it's a little hard to imagine the row after row of small cells that were here. They've been removed. But there are some photos of the bad old days. The imposing stone walls surrounding the prison are still mostly there. The Michigan State Prison was not just a place to hold prisoners, it was a place to use the cheap labor.
You will be meeting.
There were a number of industries within the prison itself, the penitentiary itself, as well as down what is called Mechanics Street. So how many actually worked in here and how many were sent out to work under the auspices of private industry?
I would say maybe a quarter were out and three quarters were in. And the variety of factories from binder twine to the world famous Jackson Wagon Factory that built a wagon to carry Jumbo the elephant from the Barnum and Bailey Circus, a 13,000-pound elephant. You can imagine the expertise of the wagon builders to build a wagon that could carry that load, and that was the inmates of MSP.
This penitentiary started out, as we said, a wooden fort. Because Michigan was growing so fast, the number of people in prison grew so fast, there had to be constant additions. So how fast did this place grow?
The West Wing was started after the fort disaster, and that was in 1842. It was fairly well completed by 1848, though they added two more tiers. But then, as soon as it was completed, it got overcrowded, and they added the West End Wing, where I now live. And it wasn't long until that became overcrowded. So we're talking basically over a period of 40 years. Till the entire thing by 1882, with the East Wing, the East End Wing, the magnificent administration building, and all the factories. So it was a gradual process, but it's a fortress. I mean, they don't build buildings like this anymore.
As the prison continued to grow and grow, just how big did it get?
By the time this closed, actually before, as I said, by 1882, it was the largest walled prison in the world. That meant acreage and numbers of prisoners. Having, by the way, been condemned in 1914, but it took all that long to build the State Prison of Southern Michigan, in the East End wing, they had to double them up like a dormitory room, and it was supposed to be for six, and it ended up being for 12. And they still didn't have flush toilets. It was still the honey buckets, even then. But of course, it was beautiful from the outside with coiffed gardens on the front of it, and the inside was horrendous. Between the honey buckets and the stench and being bathed twice a month, put in a bucket with cold well water, not allowed to wear underwear was part of the humiliation, and their uniforms were washed supposedly twice a month. So there were, you know, diseases and stench and lack of ventilation. And perhaps the worst thing, because we people talk, was the code of silence. That became a federal law in the big houses around the nation. You could not talk unless an authority engaged you in a conversation. And as soon as that was done, you were to be silent.
So no talking between the prisoners, no talking if a prisoner needed something. They couldn't ask?
They had to, for example, in a factory, if they ran out of leather or whatever the items were, they had to raise their hand. And depending upon the foreman, there were some that were a little more lenient than others. If you said, "Sir, I'm losing time, I have a quota," and spoke out like that, you could end up with bad time and in solitary, or wearing the iron cap, this heavy, heavy, literal medieval torture. And it ruined the collarbone. You could not remove it for a minimum of 14 days. You had to eat and sleep with it on. And there were other horrendous punishments for breaking the code of silence. Your hands, your wrists, were chained together, and a hook was put under the chain, and you were hoisted up with your feet 4 to 6 inches off the ground and left hanging that way for anywhere from 5 hours to 72 hours. And by the time you were taken down, your rotocuffs, your shoulders, your collarbone, you name it, you had no sensation left in your arms. So a lot of the inmates, most of whom were whipped, punished, they went out maimed. And they were supposed to live a normal life and get work and, you know, scars all over their bodies. It was horrendous. It was medieval, there is no doubt.
For most of its statehood, Michigan has not had a death penalty. Instead, those who were sentenced to life in prison for murder spent their time in solitary. That was in the basement. No light. No ventilation. At one point, state inspectors visited to see how the prisoners, including those serving a life sentence in solitary, were doing.
When the inspector found them, he was so horrified that their nails had grown like claws if they hadn't chewed them off. The hair was matted. They were crawling with bugs and, you know, vermin. And 9 of them could just grunt and had to be sent to the mental institution. And 6 of them carried out to the infirmary in the sun like brine shrimp from the Great Salt Lake exposed to sunlight died. And that was the result of something that we can say was so humane. 1846, Michigan was the first state ever to abolish capital punishment, but the punishment was then life in solitary, which is 20 of them, sentenced to that. 15 years later was when the inspectors came and found them malnutrition. So they went to the state legislature and said, reinstate capital punishment. The legislature did not. They said, instead, you wouldn't be condemned to life in solitary, but life in prison. And the term lifer originated right here at Michigan's first state prison.
This kind of behavior, this kind of treatment went on for decades. But finally, before this prison closed in 1934, there were some changes.
There were definite changes. They began actually in 1870 with John H. Purvis. He was the first reformer, and he said you have to be firm but compassionate. And then came Warden Hatch, who started educational programs saying if a man goes out educated, he'll have a better chance not to return. But the most amazing one was 1933, the very last chaplain at MSP, Albert M. Ewart. He believed that the arts were rehabilitative, and he formed a studio. He was a jack of all arts, and he taught painting and writing and whatever art, music composition. And in my book, Harry Evans, alias in the prison, John Blood, became a poet. He had a 15-year sentence for grand larceny. He got out after 7 and never returned. And I firmly believe it's because he found this marvelous form of expression within himself. And one of his very powerful poems is in my book, Jacktown.
After the prison closed, after the penitentiary closed in 1934, it was used by the military as an armory for a long time. But that's not what it is today. Tell me about what the Michigan State Prison Penitentiary is today.
It is the only old penitentiary repurposed into a residence and, to boot, an artist's residence community. And as walking through here, you can see the bars are still on the windows, but next to them hangs art, the art of the artists here at Armory Arts Village.
And you actually live here.
I live here, and I love my apartment. I chose it when the renovation was first beginning, and it was some 36 prison cells. I had no idea what my apartment would look like. And when I moved in here from Miami, Florida, thanks to WDET Detroit and its report about this that I heard in Miami, Florida, and brought me here, I came on January 5th, 2008, in the midst of a blizzard, shook and thought, oh my God, what have I done? And when I finally, shaking, got the key into the door and opened it, I was astounded at the magnificent job it was the Quinn Group, the architects, had done, still retaining the integrity of the building, the brick, the concrete, the bars on the windows, but really making unique apartments.
What's the lesson to be learned from Michigan's first state penitentiary?
The lessons to be learned, in my opinion, are that it was very medieval and punishment was considered a means of deterring others from committing crime, and the punishments were physical. I don't think we've really come all that far. Today, there aren't whippings and such, but there's more psychological damage done, and we still think that punishment will deter crime, but statistics don't prove it. My feeling is this history is utterly fascinating. It's such a part of Jackson, of Michigan, and of humanity, because it is, you know, like what was going on then. But I also think there are lessons to be learned about thinking about what are we doing today with those who are incarcerated? And how can we truly have a person come out of prison truly rehabilitated and ready to live in normal society again?
The book is Jacktown, History and Hard Times at Michigan's First State Prison by Judy Gail Krasnow. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. We always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on? What issues do you want to hear more about? We'd like you to let us know. Find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio, and, of course, at michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. You might have heard that Ontario Power Generation wants to bury low and medium-level nuclear waste at its Bruce Generation plant less than a mile from Lake Huron. U.S. officials want to block it. The Canadian government is considering the request. But how much of a risk is it, really? What is low-level and medium-level nuclear waste? Here to talk about that is Samuel Brinton. He's a nuclear engineer, and he's with the American Nuclear Society. That's a group of nuclear industry professionals. Let's start with the basics. What is low-level nuclear waste?
Low-level nuclear waste is, as I like to describe it, everything else that isn't necessarily the nuclear fuel going into and coming out of a reactor. So if you think about it in terms of a car, instead of the gasoline which runs the car, it's the car cushions, it's the wipe down that you might do onto a car, it's any of the McDonald's burgers that you have inside the car. That's all possibly low-level waste. So it's come into contact with a radioactive surface or a radiation itself, but it isn't necessarily high-level nuclear waste coming out of a reactor.
So it could be tools or cleaning material or protective suits, stuff like that that's been exposed but isn't dangerously high in radioactivity.
Exactly. Anything that was inside that reactor space used for cleaning or for construction or decommissioning and just is no longer really, really strongly radioactive.
And I understand that universities and hospitals even produce low-level nuclear waste.
That is absolutely correct. Even if every single nuclear reactor was shut down in the country today, we would still have low-level waste production because when you get that X-ray, some of the radiation is obviously going to be placed in the environment. There's a reason that we wear those lead vests to protect ourselves. So that's other low-level medical waste that we would have to take care of.
Sam, if you are exposed to low-level radioactive material, how dangerous is it to your health?
It's not something you want to do every day, but it also will not be something that will immediately harm you really, really quickly. So low-level waste won't necessarily give you cancer right away. However, long periods of engagement with low-level waste could obviously be extremely harmful to your health. That's why we manage it. Radiation does damage to biological materials, and so we want to make sure that that radiation is properly protected.
How long does this low-level nuclear waste remain dangerously radioactive?
On the order between 100 and maybe a couple hundred years. So it can obviously be much shorter, but in general, we classify low-level waste as something on the order of a couple hundred years of radiation ability. Now, it's obviously dropping as time goes on. You may have heard the term of a half-life, so over time, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller exponentially, but it is definitely reducing, but will still be around and needs to be managed for a couple hundred years.
I want to get to that Canadian waste disposal in a moment, but let's look at what's happening in the U.S. About three decades ago, the federal government mandated the states form compacts and locate regional low-level nuclear waste disposal facilities. Some states spent tens of millions of dollars studying the issue, trying to find a site, but in the end, today, the U.S. only has four sites, the granddaddy of them all, in Barnwell, South Carolina, others in Texas, Utah, and Washington State. Why are the states unable to deal with low-level nuclear waste as mandated by the U.S. government?
The ability to manage low-level waste is something that obviously takes a significant amount of preparation, as well as a community that recognizes both the risks and the benefits of that low-level waste. So what we have found is that communities require further attention and further power and support when trying to make these decisions. And when given the decision ability, many of them choose that it's not the right place for them, that low-level waste does not bring in the amount of jobs that they were hoping and just brings in the risk of a potential nuclear challenge. Now, this nuclear waste is, when properly managed, will do no harm to the environment, but the community has a right to feel that that risk needs to be compensated in a strong way. If that compensation isn't high enough, that's when you tend to have limited amounts of sites that are providing this service to the rest of the sites. So, for example, in Texas, it's serving 34 states that don't have compacts with other sites. So it's taking in quite a lot of low-level waste. It has the ability to do that. And so we're seeing that there is definitely an economic incentive for some of these sites to do their service, but that it's not right for every community.
In the case I followed for quite a while, it was really just a big case of NIMBY, not in my backyard. There seems to be a high level of, I'll just put it bluntly, ignorance about nuclear waste or radioactivity. Is that part of the problem?
Absolutely. The not in my backyard syndrome kind of stems from this popular culture image that nuclear waste is this green glowing goop that Homer Simpson accidentally dumps into a lake and a three-eyed fish appears.
I think they're more worried about Godzilla, actually.
It's possible. And I don't know, I'm sure you probably saw, but in one of the latest Godzilla movies, he literally attacks Yucca Mountain, where there's supposedly going to be high-level nuclear waste, which we'll talk about later on. So there's this popular culture discussion of how nuclear waste is this dangerous, unknowable force, and radiation is invisible. You can't see it. So there's something to be said for the fear around it. However, with the proper management and the proper precaution, nuclear waste does not harm humans. In actuality, low-level waste is obviously transported to these sites every single year in the droves and has never caused a radiation release to the local communities around them. So I think there is something definitely to be said for making sure that we properly communicate about what nuclear waste is, what it isn't, and how we can manage it safely.
The proposed design that I'm familiar with for one of these disposal facilities was a concrete bunker that was to be filled with barrels of low-level nuclear waste items mixed with concrete in the barrel. Then the barrel would be placed in the facility, backfilled with some kind of granular material. Once the facility was filled, it would be sealed. But what we're actually using right now is basically a clay-lined landfill. And you know, at that Barnwell, South Carolina site I was talking about, there's a plume of contaminated groundwater now. Are any of these U.S. facilities more than just a clay-lined landfill?
Many of them are. To be quite honest, the clay-lined landfill is the typical simple version. Now, they are saying that this is an appropriate precaution and appropriate management because the water won't be able to seep into these locations and therefore won't be able to hurt the water table. As you've pointed out, that obviously can be incorrect.
Yeah, clearly if you've got tritium levels in your groundwater, there's a problem, yeah.
There's a problem. There is a problem. Our problem has gotten better than it was in the past. I graduated from MIT, so I tend to talk about the stories of nuclear waste, including low-level waste, used to literally be dumped in the Boston Harbor. When it wouldn't sink, they would shoot these barrels of nuclear waste so that the water would go into the barrel and it would sink to the bottom of the bay. And we, to this day, do not know where some of these things are.
Brilliant.
So yes, I agree that there is definitely some challenges that we need to manage in low-level waste now, but we are definitely learn from our mistakes of the past.
Let's talk about this proposed low-level nuclear waste facility in Canada. It's proposed to be built next to the Bruce Nuclear Power Plant, which is less than a mile from Lake Huron. It's called a deep geologic repository. It's 680 meters down into the earth. That's about 4/10 of a mile. Why go that route for low-level radioactive waste?
There are two ways to manage nuclear waste, including low-level waste and high-level waste. You do it through physical barriers, and you do it through engineered barriers. The physical barriers are the deeper you put it underground, the less chance it has to raise to the surface and hit the public environment. An engineered barrier is what type of material do you put it in underground so that it never even reaches the underground environment. Those are the two systems that are being undertaken. Now, Canada is recognizing that just like we are still learning how to properly manage nuclear waste in the United States, we can always do better. And a deep geological repository is something that is agreed to by every major nation as a proper form of managing nuclear waste. It is a way of keeping it both far from the environment as well as in geologic formations that look to stand the test of time.
Let me stop you, because this is not far from the environment. It's less than a mile from Lake Huron, and the Great Lakes throughout their history have been at different levels. What if Lake Huron water level rises enough to swamp the repository or the entrance to it?
Swamping the entrance to a repository does not mean that water would necessarily wash down into these types of repositories. There's, as you mentioned with low-level waste in the past, backfill materials make sure that nothing comes out, but also nothing goes in. There's a double protection of these sites in that the materials used to coat around the containers, as well as the immense amount of security that it takes to even get into these sites, means that water, even if it was rising, would not necessarily just rush into a deep geologic repository. Yes, I recognize that a mile may not seem like a far distance away, but these are roughly 3 to 4 Washington monuments deep. The depth at which this low-level waste is being managed puts it at 1.2 kilometers, again, I'm trying to make this in the Canadian terms as well, of the hypotenuse between the lake and the depth of where this would be located. So I recognize it could be placed other locations. This is something that nuclear waste will always have a challenge with. It could be placed in optimal locations. The problem is, if there's an optimal location, it may be that humans either occupy that space or there's not proper geologic formation. So what we noticed is that down, so far down where these repositories are assumed to be located, there's a high salinity rate. That means that if there's a lot of salt, there wasn't water, because the water has obviously been dried up and has left that location, because if there was water there, the salt would obviously have eroded past. With high salinity, you recognize that this doesn't seem to be an opportunity for nuclear waste to hit the environment quickly. We need to make sure that we're still monitoring it. Many repositories, including the Canadian system, will have at least 50 years of monitoring and retrievability built into the law. Others are going even longer. For Canada, they're talking about on the order of a century of monitoring and retrievability. So if the lake starts to rise and there needs to be an immediate moving of this nuclear waste, that would also be something that could be managed.
The final question I have regarding this is, okay, I heard your assurances. I heard the physical barriers you're talking about, the engineered barriers. But couldn't something like this be placed anywhere, and it would be better than right next to one of the Great Lakes, which is a system that holds 20% of the world's accessible fresh water?
That's a great question. Yes, it could be placed in other locations. However, it seems that the science and the politics has centered on this as a prime location. Why? Because of the site that it currently is at. You mentioned that this is going to be at the Bruce Nuclear Power Station. Now, many would argue that maybe having a nuclear power plant that close to the Great Lakes isn't a great idea, but it's obviously operated for a significant amount of time without damage to the Great Lakes. We want to make sure that the environment is protected, and I think that every nuclear engineer like myself wants to make sure that they're leaving the world a better place for their kids. However, it seems to be that the geologic location for this station, and the reason that they're putting it so far underground, is because this seems to be a prime location for the quick and efficient management of nuclear waste.
You understand that the public sees this as a lot of risk for a little benefit, and it doesn't risk just Canada. It doesn't risk just that area. It risks everything downstream from there. That's why people are concerned.
And I think they should be concerned. I get quite annoyed sometimes with my fellow nuclear engineers when they disregard the direct concerns that the public has. I think there's something to be said for recognizing a concern and doing everything you can to address it. In locations that have been storing nuclear waste in the past, as the public has created questions, the nuclear industry and others have tried to do their best to respond to those questions and to address those concerns with further additional barriers or further study. We will see. If this is not a safe location, the community and the government would be held accountable for moving it to a more appropriate location. And I look forward to working with both Canada and here in the United States in our political system to make sure that something we call consent-based siting, where the community not only is engaged in this process, but recognizes both the risks and the benefits of this storage as a national priority, but also as a local concern. And so with consent-based siting and with a lot of other viable conversations around the risks, I think we have an opportunity here to talk about nuclear waste and the intergenerational issues that this is going to bring. Sometimes what is lost is that we're talking about the Great Lakes now. And as you mentioned, the Great Lakes could change in the future. And nuclear waste is on the order of a couple hundred years. This low-level waste is a couple of hundred years of safe management. We need to make sure that not only is nuclear waste managed for that period of time, but that we have a government willing to be held accountable for their actions for that period of time as well. The citizens' voice in the siting of nuclear waste has been and should continue to be a critical voice. We must study the issue and we must hold those who represent us accountable to make sure that the proper precautions are taken.
Samuel Britton is with the American Nuclear Society. Thanks for talking with us about this.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings is joining us now. You've got a cocktail for us?
I do. It's berry season in Michigan. The black raspberries are just coming into market now. Strawberries are done, but soon we'll be seeing an endless stream of awesome berries.
So berries, that sounds fun. What are you mixing with it?
I like to use bourbon in the summer with berries. I think that combination just works really well. Whenever I pick some fruit from the garden and I think, oh, I want to make a cocktail with this, bourbon's the first thing that I think of. So we're just making a simple smash.
What kind of bourbon?
Today we're using the Traverse City Whiskey Company bourbon, and they're making bourbon all over the state now. And so this one we've got from up north, which is also a great place to go in the summer.
Okay, well, we know there's berries and whiskey in there. What do you do? How do you make this?
The thing I love about this drink is that it's less of a recipe and more of an idea. So you're going to take a piece of ginger, if you like ginger, and you're going to muddle it in a shaker. And then you're going to take some berries, blueberries, raspberries, black raspberries, mulberries, whatever you have. Throw them in there with whatever herb you like. Today we use sage. You could use mint, anything you like, really, thyme. And then you're just going to muddle that all up. Break up the ginger, break up the berries, add some bourbon, but you could use rye if you wanted to. And then going to add some lemon juice and some simple syrup. So I use 2 ounces of whiskey and then half an ounce each of lemon juice and simple syrup. But you could totally adjust that based on your preferences and how sweet or tart your berries are.
Is there a trick to muddling? I know if you muddle mint too much, it gets bitter. But is there a certain number of times you smash that stuff together?
With mint, you definitely want to be careful and not muddle it too much. Mint and basil can get bitter, but something like sage or thyme or rosemary, the heartier herbs, you can really kind of beat those up. One trick to avoid over-muddling is just to have some liquid in the glass when you're muddling, so your simple syrup goes in there at the same time, or here the berries are protecting the herbs from getting too beaten up.
So this is pretty refreshing. I mean, the fruit is right there up front.
Definitely, especially with black raspberries, because they're just so powerful. I mean, you can see the color here, right? It looks like a glass of Kool-Aid, but don't let your kids into it.
No, that'll be gone before the kids even see it. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
And a quick note before we go, the show today featured some interviews that we've aired earlier this year on Stateside. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.